I was smoking 30 a day, drinking probably, I don't know, half a bottle of vodka a day. I was taking as much cocaine as I could. I was near bankruptcy. My life was in just the worst darkness.
True Decay. Welcome to the Unbranded Podcast. The Unbranded Podcast was created by Brandwagon to look into the lives of entrepreneurs, founders, CEOs, business leaders who develop brands. Because we really feel that the history, the stories of these people have had such an impact on the brands that they built. And the more interesting the life story, the more interesting the brand. We also believe at Brandwagon that better people make better brands and a better brand makes a better world. And so we really believe that you're one of those people who've really contributed strongly to creating a number of great brands, but even more creating a much better world by the stories that you reveal through the brands that you've built. And it is a huge honor and a privilege to have you here, mainly because you don't get interviewed very, very often. So, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed. No, this is my second interview and I'm extremely, extremely honoured and slightly blushing from your intro in your description. That's an awesome intro.
Thank you. I think that was a compliment. It was really tough for me to get behind the history of Trudy, to figure out, like, you know, to look up and do some research, because there are no interviews about you. I mean, a couple of about the runs, a couple about some stories there, but nothing that really goes into the life of. And you've been very vocal about your life on your own podcast, which is great. And it's typical for me in these podcasts to start off from the beginning, but I'm going to pause on that. And because I think, you know, what we're going to be revealing today, we're going to be talking about today, is going to have such a huge impact on so many people's lives that I think I'm going to start from where we are today.
Okay.
And I think it'd be great to talk about the interviewer and the great event that you're hosting in a couple of weeks' time. So you can tell us a bit about that. But you've really managed to use your platform, use your podcast, which is probably one of the most listened to podcasts in Malta, probably even, you know, growing outside the Malta as well, outside these shores, to really, one, expose the real stories of women and to really empower women to come out with their story and use that as a force of good. And also empower people to really understand, you know, how their stories have an impact on people's lives and how that can take it further. Tell me a bit about the podcast and tell me sort of, you know, what were the most remarkable moments of you figuring out, wow, this is having a huge impact.
Well, in which case I'm sort of going to slot in midway, mm-hmm. and I'm going to talk about the launch and the concept of the She Word. And for that, I have to thank a very dear friend of mine, Maxine Attard, because prior, as you mentioned, prior to this podcast, and still running now, I have a podcast called The Interviewer. When I find somebody that I want to interview, I sort of say, hey, listen, we need to sit down. We need to have a podcast. But it was with Maxine, who we are intrinsically connected through some very key events in our lives, that I said to her, listen, come on The Interviewer. Come and let me interview you about being an actress in Malta. And she said to me, listen, Trudes, I've just had a miscarriage. Can I come and talk about that? And she was 3 weeks out of a miscarriage. And I said, yes, of course. Now, this was before we had wine on the show. And this was just because we knew each other so well. She spoke very, very openly and honestly about what happens to women when they have a miscarriage. And she spoke about the process. She spoke about the emotions. We both cried and we really connected and we have that energy and that level of trust. And I put the podcast out and I thought to myself, I know this is going to be good. I've interviewed enough people. I've probably interviewed about 3,000 people in my career. And I knew this was going to be a good one, but we put it out and it had about 40,000 hits in the first 48 hours.
Oh, wow.
And this was a podcast that really, up until that point, really didn't have much attention. And women were just saying, coming back and saying, thank you for talking about that. And how it had affected them. And I'm sort of trying to gather my thoughts because it was so overwhelming, the response. Women who had had miscarriages 20 years before and still living with it. Women who had had miscarriages recently, their mum had had a miscarriage, their sister, their child had had a miscarriage. And miscarriages affect one in four women.
Yeah, it's more common than most people think.
Massively common, but it is hugely emotional and has huge taboo. For whatever reason, women don't talk about it. And there we were taking a topic and just blowing it open. And as Maxine left the studio, she said, listen, there's this podcast I want you to look at. It might be something that you should do. And it was called the Hollywood Roundtable. And I went and looked at it and I said to myself, you know what? We'd have a number of short shows talking about women in theatre and in Malta because it's very limited.
It's not a big industry.
But the combination of the two was really the birthplace of the She Word. And I went round to see a friend of mine, Sam Robedo, and I sat at her kitchen table with her and I said, listen, I've got this idea. You are a really powerful advocate for women, women's rights and empowering women. I said, what do you think of the idea? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, where should we film it? And she said, I don't know, you know, that's your biggest challenge. And I said, hang on a second. This kitchen table. I said, we should be filming at a kitchen table. And she said to me, but what kitchen? I said, well, can we film at your kitchen table? And so we started off the first two seasons doing that. And the response from it was just phenomenal and has been and surprising. And there are some very key moments. There's been a lot of tears on the show.
There's some great laughs as well.
There has been some. There's been some brilliant fun. And I think that's part of the magic, is that each show has laughs and tears and honesty. And it comes down to the fact that I feel that possibly I found my niche in being able to facilitate these conversations. And they are so, so, so powerful and surprising results. Some conversations that I thought would do really well, you know, people have gone, okay, that's nice. And then conversations, for instance, the most watched show, most listened to show is Women Child Free. And that was the opportunity that we had to reach out across the world to women all over the world and men coming back and commenting, most watched, most commented, most followed, most shared show of all time. And because people don't talk about women who are child free. So the strap line of the show is conversations that women rarely have, but really should. And that is what we do.
That's so good. That's so good. That's absolutely brilliant. And I've listened to a number of the podcasts and I've listened to a number of the episodes. And it's just, you have such a way in getting out people's stories, but also empowering them to talk. And that's even pre-wine. Okay? and I think developing this, the She Word brand, I think this is, you know, you've been so good at getting those stories out, and yet you have such a great story to tell. And this is what I want to, you know, kind of bring us back into the conversation. Yesterday, you were very open with me as we were prepping for today's show about what you've been through. And if we look at the career side of it, that's really interesting. You know, you graduated as a designer, you came to Malta, you did creative direction, you've worked in some really good agencies, you had a stint at building your own, then you moved on to TV, you had a show, you were a DJ, you're a compere, you're a great presenter, you're running your own podcast. But after, and I always took that for granted. Yeah, that's true, she's really cool, she's really good, yeah, she's really fun, it's always good, you know, to be around. But you, when you shared your story yesterday, I was so touched by that, because you've had every single reason, every single issue that would have made most people quit. And even just the little chapters, each individual of those chapters would have been enough to make a lot of people quit. And yet somehow you found so much strength in yourself to not only, you know, use that as a source of strength to build what you have now. I mean, you're a super successful person. You're admired and you're respected by so many people, and you know, on this island and even outside these shores. And yet what you've been through would have knocked most people down. And if you're happy to share that with us today, I think that'd be amazing, because I think it'd be really, you'd be really able to empower more and more people, and not just, you know, from the female generation, from the female segment of the market, but also a lot of entrepreneurs who were stuck, who have come really close to some really big problems and just don't find the strength to continue going. I found it extremely touching and extremely inspiring.
Well, look, thank you. And thank you for your kind words. I don't know why I get very embarrassed when people say great things, and maybe it's because we don't say enough to each other. But I wouldn't be able to do what I do now if I hadn't had my backstory. And I want to be very clear about that. I'm not saying that my backstory was, you know, I'm grateful for it. And I'm, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, everything good, you know, something good comes out of everything. I'm not going to say that, because quite frankly, if something is shit.
You can say that.
Oh, good. If something's shit, it's shit. You call it out for being what it is. Mm-hmm. But if you do have the opportunity to use that backstory, then that is a massive blessing. And I probably wouldn't be able to do the she word if I didn't have the ability to relate to other people in so many ways. Mm-hmm. So I'm English. I grew up in London, and then moved to the country. And my childhood, I'm a child of the 70s, birthday in just a few days, big one coming up. But I'm
apparently.
A child of
apparently.
I'm a child of the 70s, and we had our own personal challenges in our childhood. And mine was not a smooth ride. And at 13, I developed eating disorders, anorexia, then bulimia, self-harming, severe depression, which is what we'd call it now. At the time, you know, I just would pull back into myself and come out again. Ironically, very popular with my friends at school, my group. But that's kind of the show. That's that's the part that you put
the
across.
Polish sheen.
A couple of, you know, very dodgy days there with some pills and stuff like that. And I came out of that period. And at that time, when I was 17, I was just sort of trying to build myself out of that. And one fantastic thing happened. I had the opportunity to go and live in New York for a couple of months. And that was back in the time, I have to say, I'm pretty sure you'll understand, there was no mobile phones, there was no internet, there was no emails, there was no anything like that. So I went to the US and I said to the people I was working for, listen, can I call my parents to let them know that I've got here? And they said, nope, you can write a letter. So for 5 days,
no one knew
where I was. And I was there with my best friend. But it gave me, and that was the first time I'd left the UK, but it gave me that sort of boost to start seeing my way out. And I can see right now, when I look back, I can see that that was a really key part of my journey. I'd had a very, very dark, maybe 5 years. And then I start to see my way out. And then I came back to the UK. And unfortunately, I met the person who I ended up marrying at 24. Before we got married, we got engaged at 21. Now, you have to remember, this is out in the country in the, you know, the 90s. Before we got married, he had an episode of sleeping with prostitutes and some really dodgy behavior. And I found out just before I was about to go out to see a friend in Australia, because I got the bug for traveling. And we were engaged at the time. And literally from the day we got engaged, he started this behavior until I found out. And I had to make a decision. And I decided that I was going to stick with him and I was going to get married. Now, I'm going to just pop in there and say, every single person is born with a gut instinct. And your gut is never wrong. We learn to override it. And for me, that happened in my childhood. There were some things going on in my childhood that I said to myself, how can this happen? If these people say that they love me, how can they be behaving like this? So maybe my gut is wrong. But your gut is never wrong. Mm-hmm. It's always right. Whether it's in business, relationships, friendships, marriage, children, it's always right. And so I had learned to override that, and I didn't come back to finding that until I was 45. But I then went on and I married this guy, and unfortunately that didn't work out very well. And this is where we were being very candid yesterday. He ended up, shortly after we got married, he ended up going back to this behavior of sleeping with prostitutes. And at one point he decided he wanted to get out of the marriage, and he brought someone home that instigated me being party to that. So in other words, he brought someone home, he locked the door, he let them have me, and he decided that that was an excuse for him to tell his family that I had been unfaithful. I tried to fix this relationship, this marriage. I didn't want to give up. I was determined. You know, there's a lot of, we just had a podcast on the She Word, a series of podcasts about narcissists and how narcissists train you to behave in certain ways, where you will keep going and keep going and keep going because you think that you can rectify the situation. And that is what I had learned, and I kept doing it. And I unfortunately found myself, after having graduated in 97, worked in London in some amazing design agencies. I had really had a fantastic career in London. And a couple of things came together at the same time. One, recession hit. If you haven't lived through a recession, that is its own joy. Imagine COVID without the sort of the security of maybe being supported by the government. There was no support. We were in recession. Everybody lost. I had 110 designers on the floor in an agency. We all lost our jobs, and there were no jobs on the market. So I find that I'm also trying to, in a way of rectifying this situation with my husband, because I don't want to give up, even despite everything that happened. I was paying for him to live in an apartment near me. And then that started to deteriorate. I started to get pimps banging down my door because he'd given them my address, and they were coming to get money, and they were coming to threaten me. And of course, this all happened around the time of the recession, and things just broke down. And I found myself in a situation where I was on antidepressants, really high medication. I was smoking 30 a day, drinking probably, I don't know, half a bottle of vodka a day. I was taking as much cocaine as I could. I was near bankruptcy. My life was in just the worst darkness. I was self-harming. I was covered in scars. And I found myself one day sleeping. I couldn't afford my flat anymore, because of what had happened, because of the debts that had been run up by him and also by the recession. And I found myself sleeping on the floor of my studio, my one room studio, which was in a block of creatives. And that's what I was doing. And it was a August bank holiday, and it was a Friday night, and I was alone. And my friends had really, at that point, they had abandoned me, because I was not somebody that people wanted to be around. And I sat there, and it was a beautiful, beautiful summer's day. And I realized no one was coming back to the office until Tuesday, because of public holiday. So Friday night, I sat on the windowsill of this six-story building. And I said, that's it. I'm going. I have nothing left. There is nothing. I have no husband, no friends, no life, no money, no career, no anything. There's nothing. And I sat there, and I leant forward, and I looked down. And I put my hand out, and as I put my hand out, the branch that I touched slipped. And it was enough for me to fall forward and say to myself, okay, I don't want this. And a voice said to me, you have to go back and you have to start again. So I packed my things, I left the key, I went across to Liverpool Street Station. I sat there, I waited for a train. It was the only money I had left. And I got on the train and I went to my parents. And I turned up and I said, it's this or death. And my parents said to me, okay. Now my parents, bless them, we hadn't had a good relationship in the past. But when I needed them in this situation, they came through and they didn't judge. And I'm not sure if they didn't judge or they didn't know how to judge, because I think I'm not a parent. I don't know what that would be like if your child turns up and says, you know, I'm I've I'm at this lowest point. I have nothing. And if I'm not here, I'm not going to make it. And so I stayed with them for a couple of months over the summer. I tried to pull things back together, and slowly, one step at a time, I was still drinking heavily, and I decided to self-medicate myself off the antidepressants. I was on a 60 milligrams a day of a drug called Ceroxat, which is three times the recommended dose. And so I was breaking up the pills and just measuring them in grams and trying to get off this. And it was a journey. It was a journey from an incredibly dark place, and a dark place where there was nothing else. There was no one else. And I literally had reached out, and my parents said, okay, come back, start again. And that's what I had to do. I had to build my life at what I'd been 29, 28, 29, and I had to start all over again. And there was, some habits that took harder to kick than others. But at that day that I left, I said, okay, no more cocaine, no more marijuana, nothing. And I've never touched that since. And I started again. There's reasons I mentioned that is because I also became aware of my personality type. Mm-hmm. My personality type is, if I'm dedicated to something, I'm going to do it wholeheartedly.
All in.
If I'm going to smoke, I'm going to smoke 30 a day. You know what I'm saying? If I'm going to drink, I'm going to drink a lot. And if I'm going to take cocaine or whatever it is, I'm going to do it wholeheartedly. I'm in for everything. So I did start again. I had then the opportunity to go and shortly after, about 3 or 4 months afterwards, I went to work for as a creative director for a design agency who were amazing agency. Their main client was Ann Summers, which, if you don't know, is a sex shop in the UK, a sex shop chain. But the owner of the company was also a guy called Norman Sheffield, who'd managed Queen for the first, no I think way. It's 8 albums. And I'd been working, and one of the reasons they got me is because the last job I'd had was working for Telstar Records, and I was leading a team there. And he had a relationship with them. And I went in to work in Hertfordshire for this company, and it was the beginning of a new life. But it was new friends, new script, new journey, new start. And that was the point where I said, okay, I'm going to start again.
And this is the first time where you probably could really feel who you really were. And no.
That was still a long way off.
Of self-discovery.
It's been a long journey. There were plenty of screw-ups. I'm not going to tell you that was a day where everything started going right. That was a dark place to come from. And I went, without being wanting to be too graphic, but I'll tell you a story. At one point, I was still in my apartment. I had no money. This in London. I had no money. The electricity had been cut off. The gas had been cut off. So I was boiling pasta in a kettle. Over and over again, I was putting the kettle on and boiling the water so I could boil this pasta. You can do it. It's really cool. And I had... And I had no money, and someone across the way had given me a bottle of homemade poutine, and I drank this poutine. Never drink poutine. It makes you go mad. And I ended up, it was the day after the pimps had broken into my home and threatened me and taken a huge amount of my belongings to pay for my husband's whatever he was doing. And I took a knife and I cut across my leg in a huge amount of places. And whilst this sounds graphic, I want to just explain that when I'm talking about dark places, I'm not talking about, oh, it was a dark place. I'm talking, it was really dark. And I took my fist and I punched it because I wanted to see how I felt. And I ended up being hospitalized. The police broke in, and a long story. But then coming back from that place, that is not a place that you just say, okay, here we go.
Of course not.
You still make the same mistakes. If you've learned a pattern of behavior, mm-hmm. you're going to make those mistakes along the way. But so I then ended up working at this agency, and then I had the opportunity to, through meeting a chap who became my boyfriend, a narcissistic sociopath, I would call him, I came to Malta. And I ended up coming to Malta in 2005 for the first time, 2006 permanently, fell in love. And that was then another part of the journey, because that's pressing a reset. Nothing here was familiar. And that really was the opportunity to say, okay, let's start again. So I've sort of gone through a journey of rediscovery and trying to relearn things. But at the same time, I'd gone into a damaging relationship. And everything that goes with that, domestic abuse, emotional abuse, you know, being cheated on and all of this. So going back to a similar place, only this time I'd taken a step forward. So this time I said, okay, that's not for me. When I found out what was going on, that's not for me. Now I'm going to try again. But then I find myself into end of 2009, 2010, I'm in Malta, in a country I have only been in 2 years because of my then partner. So I'm having to start again.
Properly from scratch.
Properly from scratch.
Where you know no one.
Yeah. And then that's when, and we talked about this before, about this perfect storm, and that's when the accident happened. So at the end of 2009, I found out that my partner was cheating on me, and I said, okay, that's not going to happen. But in the same 4 weeks, so he was cheating on me, so I had to go and find a new home. I was in the process of changing job. And so new home, no partner,
new company,
new job, and then the horse riding accident. So the horse riding accident happened on the 26th of January at 6:30 in the morning, 2010. The horse I was riding bolted, and I pulled a jockey stop. It was racing towards the road. I pulled a jockey stop. I pulled the horse over me, and I sustained 2 brain hemorrhages and ruptured spleen. That week was very interesting because they had what the
more interesting. Does it get more interesting than this?
Yeah, no, it's no. This is we aren't there. But I was in hospital, and on the Wednesday I got a call from the new job that I had gone to as a creative director, and I was advised, we're really sorry about the accident, but if you don't get back to work by Friday, I'm sorry, we're not keeping your job open. So I'm in Malta, in a foreign country, new mortgage, new rent, new life, new friends, because of my friends were with my partner. So I on the Thursday evening, I signed myself out of hospital with a drip strapped to my arm, and I went home, and the next day I went to work. And unfortunately, probably because of that, then later on I started, which is probably a more familiar story, I started experiencing accident-related epilepsy. So why is this the good bit? Well, the good bit
you
is...
You tell me why.
Because the good bit is when you are given the opportunity to overcome something that is tangible and something that you have no control over and something that you cannot take responsibility for and turn that into something good, then you really feel you have the power to do so much more. So I started getting these strange electric shocks in my body and smell hallucinations, memory disruptions. And eventually I plucked up the courage to go to the doctor, and the doctor said, you have epilepsy, accident-related epilepsy, which meant that I would experience maybe 70 seizures, up to 70 seizures over a 72-hour period. And I changed. I'd also taken on, I'd left by this point. By the time I'd realized I had epilepsy, I'd left the company that I'd been at, and I was sort of forging away, and I was teaching at MCAST, and I was sort of exploring these different avenues. And I was blown away when the doctor said, you have epilepsy. Now, epilepsy carries so much stigma with it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this cannot be happening. This really cannot. This can't be loaded on me. And at the point prior to that, I had decided to go off to Australia and become a dive instructor. And that was off the cards. And I was sort of scrambling around for work because I was no longer employed here. I made some very stupid business decisions. Very stupid. But keeping with the story for the epilepsy and the joy story and trying to keep this quite concise, I then started taking up running, which is where we connected. And I'm getting a bit mixed up because there's reason, so much going on there.
Your reason for starting running was because you did not want to get onto the drugs, because you had got away from that.
Exactly. And you didn't want to. That's where I was coming to. And thank you for bringing me back to that, because it's such a huge story. Even I get lost. So when I went to the neurologist and I was told I had epilepsy, I was told 3 tablets a day for the rest of your life. And I said, well, what does the tablets do? And they said, well, they monitor your serotonin. And I said, forget it. And the neurologist said, what do you mean? I said, well, I've been in here 10 minutes. You can tell me that I'm going to be on tablets, 3 tablets a day for the rest of my life, which is going to affect my serotonin. I don't want that choice. That's not the choice for me. So he said, well, I'm going to take your driving license away. And I said, okay, well, I know that I'm entitled to a second opinion. And I went off to see a second neurologist, Malcolm Vella, who was just amazing, and said, no, you get auras. You know when they're coming. You promise me that you'll act responsibly, you'll get off the road, we'll monitor you. You can go ahead and not take medication. So I started running just.
Were you into sports at all?
Oh, good.
This?
No, I was smoking. Yeah, no. Yeah, but
that's
not
a sport. You used to drive motorbikes fast.
Yeah.
It's not really a sport.
Yeah. I like the ones that had a bit of danger added to them.
Adrenaline junkie.
Exactly. Well, again, that comes back to the personality type. So I know the running, really the root of the running comes from a comment that boyfriend, that narcissistic boyfriend, had made in 2009 at a dinner party. We were talking about what we were going to do in the next decade. And I said, well, it's my 40th birthday in April 2014. There you go. That's my age given away. And I said, I know that the London Marathon is on my birthday. I want to run the London Marathon. Wouldn't that be amazing? I'm from London. And what an incredible thing that would be to do. And he turned around to everybody at the dinner table and said, she could never run a marathon. She has short legs and she'd run close to the ground like a Shetland pony. And I said, thanks. So that sort of sat at the back of my head. And so when I started taking up running, that was always a motivation. I always had my eye on the London Marathon. And these extraordinary, why is this important to the story? Because as I increased the running, the seizures decreased. And as I'm going to cry. As I crossed the start line of the 2014 half marathon here in Malta, I had my last seizure. I had applied for the London Marathon to run for the Epilepsy Society, and they gave me a place, and I trained to run. I was going to run the London Marathon for the Epilepsy Society on my 40th birthday, and I was going to do it with epilepsy. But lo and behold, I didn't know that my epilepsy had been cured through running.
Because the serotonins that you get from running.
Serotonins, sports. The uptake of oxygen, the regeneration of brain cells, everything that was going on up here that was being healed by
all those hours on your own out there in the cold and the sun and the heat and the dark and the
So when I crossed the finish line of the London Marathon, little did I know I'd cured myself, but I did stop and have a few good words to say to the ex-boyfriend. And also it was my 40th birthday. So that, whether it's in your personal life, whether it's in your professional life, that then gives you a benchmark. If I can do that.
If you can cure yourself from epilepsy, if you can run the marathon after all you've been through.
Yeah. What can I not do? Well, nothing really. I mean, it's just a case of putting your mind to it and trying. And I think it's worth saying at the same time, I made some really bad business decisions. I went into partnerships in that period with wrong people and was advised badly. And hands up, I'm not a great business person. I have fear of Excel spreadsheets like you would not believe. And I see them and I really literally start getting anxiety. But I think, there's a long way to go before we get to the she word. But in my mind, that was starting to learn the journey that you surround yourself with people who are good at what they do so that you can be good at what you do. And that's where I started that journey.
Yeah. Total complete rebrand, if you wish, of the old Trudy into the new Trudy.
Absolutely.
So 2004, right? 14.
We're at 2014. So I missed
that's
out
the
just...
day everything changes, more that's... or less. Well, that's a time. You can't really pick on a day, right?
You see, there's a perfect storm, Pete, because mm-hmm. at the same time as all of that happening in the backstory, there's also the event where I was a graphic designer. I went in to see a fantastic guy, Clint Bayarda, to whom I will always be grateful. And if he ever sees this, he'll probably not know the full story. But I went in to see him 2013, straight after the general election. He was on a high. He had been made head of one radio. And I sat down to talk to him about marketing a dark market campaign for British American Tobacco. And as my client, and I said to him, hey, you're in a good mood. What's happened? He said, I'm head of one radio. He said, Trudy, have you ever done radio? And this is where he'll never forgive me. I said, yeah, sure. I'd never done radio. And I said, yeah, I did something at university because I didn't want to let this pass me by. And I said, why? And he said, come and be a guest DJ on a show that I'm running on the station at the moment. I said, sure. Okay, I go along. And I went. First time I sat down, absolutely terrified. And that was the only time I've been terrified on radio. And I sat down and I got involved in this show and it was great. And I had a great time. It was only half an hour. I was a guest DJ. There were two of us that were guests on somebody else's show. And I did it for 11 weeks. And then at the end of the 11 weeks, I went off to Australia. And when I came back, we'd been given that show. And this was this is why I'm saying a perfect storm, because I fell into broadcast completely by accident and a tiny white lie. Well, actually not a white lie at all. It was a massive fib. I found my niche. I'm a great creative director. I'm not the best graphic designer. But this, I found something I could do. And I had a passion for it. And so I ended up producing 400 TV shows and 3 years of radio on one and presenting. And I was doing everything on the fly. I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea what a running order was. I had no idea how to do any of this. But I found something I loved. And I loved it more than as much as graphics and as much as marketing. And so that's where I found the final element of the perfect storm, which led me to where I am today.
Wow, that's impressive. That's a great story. And then post-marathon, though, then you decide to run around the country?
Well, this is where you fit in, because when you do overcome something, and I think this is part of where the she word fits in, and I try to encourage women. If you can overcome one thing, it doesn't have to be as massive of mm-hmm. as overcoming a situation where you're suicidal or whatever, but there are more people in that situation than we think. But if you can overcome something else, if you can overcome a near fatal accident, or if you can overcome an abusive partner, if you can overcome a number of other, you know, anything. If you can overcome it, take it, put that in your belt. That's your armor. That's what you have. And the running just became compulsive. And in the same way that cocaine had, or self-harm had, or depression had, alcohol, tobacco, it steered into a new path. Mm-hmm. And I saw Neil Edus swim round Malta, and I said, hey, listen, I give a whole lot about the environment. What he's doing is amazing and making people aware. I wonder if he'll let me run for the same cause. And he did. And that's where we touched base again. You came and ran marathons, because I did a 126 kilometers around the island without stopping. And that event was so full of hardwired moments. You remember when we stopped?
Of course I do. That was for me that was really, you know, like such a great moment in my life. I had always been, you know, training to run. Well, I've never been into running before, so I fell into running, you know, pretty much in a very similar way. And I've been planning to run around Gozo as, you know, the Xterra challenge, which you've done a number of times. And I needed to fit in a full marathon run, a 42K run. And I saw you guys were looking for some runners to help you out. And I said, like, nobody does the graveyard shift. And I had done the graveyard shift with Neil, no? We had kept him company to do, you know, the dark hours at night when he was circumventing water. I said, hey, you know what? I'll do it. I'm in. That's me. So we did that, no? And that was one of the most amazing runs still till today of my life. One, because it was the first time I did a marathon run. Two, because the company was great. And then there was that magic moment, no? When we were just getting over onto Dingley Cliffs. And the sky was absolutely stunning. And we decided to switch off all the lights. And we had cars in front of us, you know, just the patrol car. Everyone had torches. And we just switched off everything. And just for 1 minute, that sky just lit up.
Because we had run through rain.
Of course we did.
And we had the cars were with us. I can remember this.
Of course, we ran through a lot of rain.
Yeah, absolutely. And we started running the 126 kilometers at 6 o'clock in the evening, and I was aiming to finish about 3 in the afternoon the next day. And we met at St. Thomas's Bay.
Yeah, that's right.
And there was just, I think it was just you and me for a while there. And then we were joined by two other runners. And
Joe and Mark.
Yeah. And at one point, and we, as you rightly said, we had support cars. We had three support vehicles. And because at the time, and it's worth just pointing that this is 2019, and people didn't do this in 2019. Mm-hmm. Now people do this all the time. But at that time, that nobody had done this. Nobody had run around Malta for 126 kilometers. And the support cars were coming to a long climb, you remember? Mm-hmm. And they said, we cannot do this in first and second gear.
That's right.
So they had to go ahead of us and left us on our own. And you and I were the only ones with torches. And you said,
I did?
Yeah, it was definitely you. You said, let's turn off the torches. And we were in the middle of nowhere. And we just looked up. And I remember there was a shooting star.
That's right.
And, you know, and when we got to the end of that section, mm-hmm. when we came to Golden Bay, and we came around the corner as the sun came up, and I don't know if it was you or Joe said, this is a hardwired moment, and he explained it, that some memories are hardwired.
It was Joe.
And it's always going to be with you, and you're going to feel it, and you're going to smell it, and you're going to experience it. And those were two hardwired moments in my life. But a lot of people think that running is nuts and it's just, you know, but there's one thing that you and I have both experienced on that day, and because that wasn't an easy marathon.
Of course not.
But I think for anybody who gets into something like that, is that there's a point where you want to give up and you want to say, I quit. I'm not in for this. I don't want to do this. And this is what I love about marathon running or running or ultra running or anything like that, is if you can get past that point, because it's a beautiful analogy for life. If you can get past the point where it really hurts, where everything in you says, I am going to stop, I'm going to give up, I'm going to quit, nothing, it doesn't really matter, nothing matters, it's not important, no one's going to notice, I'm going to quit. If you can get past that, then you've won, because you'll never quit again.
Okay. That's absolutely true. And I've faced that in my life as well. But people out there who are at the moment in a stage in their life where something has hit them, something has punched them down. How do you find that inside you to keep on going? What is it that you tell yourself? Where does it come from?
I think for me, having been to a place that's so dark and survived that, nothing's ever going to be that bad again. Nothing could ever be that bad again. And I think it's worth anybody who's in that position reminding yourself where you have come from. And even if you're on that trajectory that is looks like it's heading downwards, I think there's also the point of saying, what's the worst that can happen? What is the worst that's going to happen? For me, what's the worst that could happen? It's happened.
Yeah, you faced the worst already.
So what else? I feel very reluctant to say, what else can you throw at me? Shh, Trudy never said that. But it's also, you know, I make it sound like, when putting it in terms of running, I make it sound like, you know, okay, you're running a marathon, you get to kilometer 37 and it really hurts and you just want to give up, or you get to kilometer, I don't know, 100 of 126 kilometers and you're like, oh, everything hurts. And then suddenly you have this magic moment. No, no, it continues to hurt. You don't suddenly turn around the corner and nothing hurts. You just take that choice that it doesn't matter how much it hurts. You are going to survive this. And you will get past this. And that's every step at a time. You're not looking at the 42 kilometers, the 126 kilometers. You're looking at the corner of the street. Let me get there. Mm-hmm. And we can reevaluate. But yeah. You get there and you're like, whoa, I made it to the corner of the street, right?
Yeah, Nilo Juice has the same similar concept now of just break it down. Don't focus on the whole end game. Just focus on the next step.
And that's
the
it.
Next step, and next step. I never told you this, but when we're doing that marathon run, I was in some serious pain. I had no idea how the hell I was going to get there. But I said I was. And I said, I mean, this girl has been running since 6 o'clock. And even when I'm done, she's only, I think, halfway.
Two-thirds, yeah.
Yeah, well, I said, I have no options here. I'm going to have to keep on doing this now. I'm going to really pick up whatever I have and just deal with it. And I remember saying to myself, it's just pain.
Yeah.
It's just pain.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't go through with it. Of course, you know, at a point like that, it is just sports pain. Life is more than just pain.
Yeah.
And I think when life throws at you something and it hits you in your heart, it hits you in your, you know, body, it hits you in your mind, and it, I suppose, challenges everything you believe about who you were or who you are or who you think you're going to be. I think those are the really tough times.
And I think you just hit the nail right on the head there about who you think you're going to be. When I was 23 and I graduated and I went to London and I got this great job, I had a very clear picture in my mind of who I was going to be. I was going to be this designer. I was going to be great. I was going to have a home. I was going to do this. I was going to do that. My life went so far away from the path. And it took so long to get back on track. I don't even know that phrase makes sense, because it would seem that I got onto the same path. Absolutely not. If you said to a younger Trudy, you know, I've had this in the podcast, what do you say to your younger self? First of all, I'd say it's going to be okay. Second of all, I'm going to say it's going to get really bad. And then you're going to see the most incredible light and have the most incredible experiences, like when we saw the stars, when we saw the sunrise. You're going to have a lifetime of incredible experiences that you could never possibly imagine. And you're going to have the opportunity one day to connect with women in a way that you could not ever imagine. Nobody wants that to happen to their lives. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to be in that place. And I keep saying I really struggle with people saying all things, you know, have a good that come out of them. Well, yeah, that maybe you do. If you put your mind to it, maybe you do. But that is not to dismiss the fact that when you're there, it is absolutely horrible. And there's no way to dress that up. You can never make that time good.
Yeah.
It was shit. And the things that happened to me were shit. But it has now, but it now has enabled me to have impact on other women. And it's an unbelievable honor. It's a huge honor to be able to hear women sharing their stories. And me to say, I get a tiny bit of your picture. I get a tiny piece of that. So you asked me about the gut. I didn't tune into my gut until I was 45. And I came out of the last of a long string of very bad relationships. And a friend of mine turned around and said to me, go read this book. And the book is called Women Who Love Too Much by Robin Norwood. And I went away, and that was probably, again, one of those epic moments in my life where I sat down. I got to tell you the story. I had been putting off reading the book for about 6 months. I ordered the book to be delivered to my parents. I was going to my parents for a couple of days. I sat down on a Ryanair flight, seat 9C. And I had downloaded the prologue and the first chapter of this book onto my phone. And I sat down to read it. We took off. You know how Ryanair flights are. Along comes the little trolley with the woman. I'm like, yeah, I'll take a glass of wine. And I read the prologue and this is interesting. And the first two-thirds of the book are stories of women who have been in extraordinarily difficult places. And then the last third is sort of the theory of how to stop making those mistakes mm-hmm. and stop doing the same thing over and over again. Exactly. And the last story, the very last chapter, is the tail end of the first chapter and the results of the book. And I looked at it and I started reading it. And the main character is called Trudy. Now that you never see Trudy. You can't write it. Well, somebody did. But nobody ever has a... The only Trudy I knew growing up was the Tupperware Lady's Scotty dog. You know, I never knew any other Trudys. And I looked around. I'm sitting in 9C and I look around me and I'm thinking, someone's having a joke here. This is ridiculous. So I read the book and it changed my life. And what it did was tell you that your gut is never wrong. If you've lost the ability, whether it be in business, family, friends, relationships, if you've lost the ability to listen to your gut, get back in tune with your gut. Your gut never lies to you. We override it. Mm-hmm. And I could see myself having done that for 45 years. And that's when things started to really come together and my life kind of, I don't know, some really good stuff happened. And the she word happened, and you know, I met the right person and listened to my gut, even though circumstantially they were all the wrong person. The gut said right, and I made some decisions. And even now, I'm in a process of listening to my gut business wise and questioning and saying, what is my gut saying? Is this a good choice? Is this a bad choice? It doesn't lie.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. Trudy, I'm going to ask you a question, which I normally ask everybody at the very, very beginning. Mm. But I left this to the end purposely. You are so many things, okay? Presenter, podcaster. Who is Trudy? And what does your gut say? Who does your gut say Trudy is?
How do people normally answer?
I'll tell you now. But you know later now. It's my interview, my podcast. Don't take over.
I'm sorry. Who is Trudy? A facilitator of conversations.
And?
Incredibly lucky and very blessed and an overcomer and unbelievably grateful and hopeful and passionate. And I'm now in a place of, you mentioned right at the very beginning of women coming on the podcast and feeling at ease to tell their stories. I can't explain to you why. I've had people say to me afterwards, I said too much. And I said, well, we edit it, you can take it out. But I've said too much and it's your fault because you make me too comfortable. I also think it's something to do with a really good wine. But I'm incredibly blessed to have found that thing that I do and I enjoy. And I think I do it. I found my niche to be able to stand on stage and talk. I found my niche to be on radio, on TV, podcasting. But I'm a facilitator of other people's stories. This is why I don't get interviewed. Because it's not very often that I get to tell my own story.
No, I think you're an incredibly strong person. I'm so glad to have had you on this podcast.
Thank you.
The she word.
Yes.
What's next?
Well, look, I'm going to just tell you, Pete, this was never meant to be what it is. I mean, when I say it wasn't meant to be, it was never intended to be. I think it's that perfect storm coming together. You've had it with Brandwagon, and I'm very, very fortunate to be in a position where this she word is reaching out to women, not just here in Malta, but all around the world. And I think that is one of the things. Podcasting is great because it goes beyond the shores. It touches every gender, race, ethnic background, whatever it is, you can reach out to everybody. So we're going to keep doing the she word. The she word keeps growing, and I keep getting stunned by the response. We've had a couple of spin-offs. We've had the Young Women's Edition. That's going to be coming back. The Women in Business, my goodness. I mean, this is, women in business really have a real need to be empowered because they, a lot of women don't see their potential. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a statistic from the the World Empowerment Index, which says that women are at 61% of what they could be. And for a huge number of reasons, that lack of empowerment is stopping them. The He Word is coming. And of course, live events, we're going to be exploring and are exploring and running live events as well. And why not? Why stop in Malta? This is where we're at. But as long as women keep having conversations that they really should have but rarely do, we still have a role.
What a great place to stop the podcast. One final question.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that question I asked you at the beginning? Oh, my gosh. Soundtrack of your life, Truly Care. What is it?
I'm going to say this because when you asked me originally, and I even referenced this, can I choose three? Is that okay? Okay.
I'm going to choose.
No, you don't. No. I'm going to choose Castle on the Hill.
Okay.
Because it reminds me so much of my childhood. The town that I went to university in had a castle on the hill. Brilliant. Ed Sheeran. I'm going to say Blood of Eden by Peter Gabriel. And I can't even tell you why, but it resonates with me.
Beautiful song.
And we've got to get, you know, we've got to get you two in there. Beautiful day. I mean, that's it. That's the optimism. That's every day's an opportunity.
Those are three really good songs.
Thank you.
Well done. Truly Care. Thank you for joining us at the Unbramming Podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you and a real honor.
It's been an honor to be here.